recently lost my best friend, lost my sister.
A Métis woman is strangled at her front door in the spring of 2002.
It was a tough one right from the get-go.
And there's a single suspect.
And I said, why is this man still walking free?
He was just a con man and a manipulator.
I'm David Ridgen, and this is The Next Call, the case of Terry Dauphiny. Available now on the CBC Listen app and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm El Amin Abdul Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
In the wake of a fatal attack on a London, Ontario Muslim family, there's been an urge to say, this is not who we are, this is not what Canada is about, and this cannot happen here. Federal politicians have also had a lot to say about Islamophobia these last few days. There's a lot I want to unpack about this, Rosie, about what has been, so far, another tough week.
Indeed. I also want to continue some of our conversation from last week about reconciliation and look at how this country remembers its history and those who had a hand in building the residential school system. It's about more than just statues and names on building. How does this country come to terms with its past?
There's so much to get into, so let's go. Rosie, you and I have this recurring joke when we come to record this podcast where we, just to get it out of our system, I think we just say, I don't know where to begin. I think I'm going to say it again this week, but I really mean it this time. I genuinely don't know where to begin. I guess we should maybe begin by acknowledging the heaviness. It's been a rough stretch in the news. Last week, we talked about the remains found outside of the Kamloops Indian Residential School. This week, the heaviness continues, and we're going to try to get through it together, but it's also, I think, just good to state up front. If listeners are like, man, this feels like a continuation of the heaviness, it is not just you. It is. Yeah. It has been relentless. Okay, so the facts, just so they're established, on Sunday, a driver hit a family of five in London, Ontario. He killed four of them, and then the fifth, a nine-year-old boy, went to the hospital with serious injuries. And then on Monday, we found out more about the story. Police said this driver, a 20-year-old man, was motivated by hate, and he intentionally did this. We found out that the family were Muslim. They are the Afzal family. Salman Afzal, Madiha Salman, 15-year-old Yumna Afzal, and Salman's 74-year-old mother, Talat Afzal. We didn't, as of this recording anyway, find out what evidence police have that they know this should be treated as a hate crime. We just know that that's what they're saying. We know that the man who did this was wearing some kind of body armor-like vest. We know that this family was just out for a walk when this happened. And it has been a hard story to read about. My social media feeds are filled with people who are distraught and upset and just devastated by this. And I guess, like, I don't know why I'm putting distance in terms of, like, crediting that feeling. Like, I'm feeling that way, too. I'm also distraught and upset by the story. Hmm. And we're going to try to disentangle what living through all this heaviness means, what it means for our idea of Canada in a minute. But I guess, like, let's just start with, how are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the heaviness from, you know, these two events of the past couple of weeks, and also the general heaviness of a pandemic, right? We are still dealing with that. So when you get these other terrible, horrifying events that are sort of piled on top, I think resiliency becomes difficult, and certainly in this case, more difficult if you're Muslim. I think the piece that resonated for me as a white person was that family out for a walk. You know, there's so little you can do during a pandemic that almost everybody is doing that every night, going out for a walk for some peace and some fresh air and to spend time with your family, the only people you're allowed to see. And I think that's the part that I find so just shocking and violent and appalling, that this was a family like any other family during the pandemic, targeted for no good reason at all. Mm-hmm. What's been interesting to see is the response to this. There was no hesitation on the part of politicians, mayors, elected officials to call this a terrorist attack. There are, you know, there's lots of conversation about when you do that for legal reasons. But in terms of the way politicians and public officials wanted to label this act, it was blunt right out of the gate. The prime minister said this killing was no accident. This was a terrorist attack. And others agreed. And I think that that shows a shift, perhaps, in the public understanding of Islamophobia or anti-Muslim hate.
Actually, to that end, you know, you're right. We did hear from a lot of politicians on this. It's useful to get into the specifics of some of what they had to say. Why don't we maybe start with the Prime Minister? Here he is speaking at a vigil in London.
As Canadians, we make a pact with one another that we will look out for each other, take care of each other, respect each other. Well, for the Muslim Canadian community, that pact has been broken too many times. It was broken last fall in Etobicoke and in Quebec City, in far too many places across the country. Islamophobia is real. Racism is real. You should not have to face that hate in your communities, in your country. We can and we will act.
I do think that pause and the applause that he got for the statement Islamophobia is real is significant. Mm-hmm. And it's significant because it is not hard to think back on a time when just that statement was controversial. In 2017, just a couple of months after the Quebec City mosque shooting, which killed six people, there was a huge debate in this country about Motion 103. And Motion 103 was a non-binding motion in the House condemning Islamophobia after this awful, unspeakable act of terror took place. But the conservatives, who were at the time were in the middle of a leadership race, criticized the motion for using the term Islamophobia. And in the end, the motion ended up passing, but the Bloc voted against it. But almost every leadership candidate for the Conservative Party at the time, including Erin O'Toole, who's now the leader, voted against it. And I think it may be hard for people to remember now because everything has happened, but like there were protests in the streets because of Motion 103. And so for the leadership candidates who opposed it, it wasn't really hard to imagine. It's not a big stretch to imagine. They were trying to, in part, court a certain part of that energy, those people who were protesting out in the street, to get them to vote for them. And I'm thinking of that now because Michelle Rempel-Garner, who's a prominent Conservative MP, issued a statement that was in part an apology. It wasn't an apology for that, but she issued a statement this week saying, you know what, I should have spoken out about Barbaric Cultural Practices Hotline, which was a campaign idea from the Harper government way back in 2015. Her statement said, Islamophobia is real. And to me, her statement marked an interesting kind of turning point in politicians maybe acknowledging that there was a time when it was politically expedient and useful to use Islamophobia as some kind of political football. Some people saying it is real and we need to acknowledge it. And some people saying, no, like we need to have some skepticism about this concept. And maybe, hopefully, that era is over now because the response to this story has been so overwhelming. And I think like maybe it's bringing out that part of the debate. You know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe it will do that. I would say a couple things. That M103 was probably done with the best of intentions after the killing in Quebec City, the shooting in Quebec City. And because, largely because of that conservative leadership race, it became, you know, very divisive and partisan and also sort of steeped in mistruths, frankly, not only about what Islamophobia is, but also around what the motion was going to do. There were conservatives at the time portraying it as legislation, as something that was going to be done, as opposed to, you know, just a sort of a declaration of intent, which is what the motion was. So that was problematic. The 2015 election, I would have thought, would have been the end of the conversation around this stuff, because the defeat of the conservatives was very much in response to some of those positions that Michelle Rempel-Garner talked about. So I feel like we've been here before, frankly, that we've encountered things that we know are unacceptable. We've said this is unacceptable. we won't do this again. And then we've ended up in this place again. I know that's a horrible thing to say, and people may not want to hear this right now. But I would also point to Bill 21 as evidence that all is not simple or all is not resolved on this issue. So Bill 21 is the law in Quebec that prohibits people from wearing religious symbols in the public service. That obviously primarily targets people who might be wearing a hijab or a turban or something very visible. It is viewed by many as racist. And yet, politicians are very reluctant to denounce Bill 21 because in Quebec, it is largely viewed as an attempt to make sure that society remains secular. And even yesterday, we're recording this on Wednesday, but even yesterday, the Prime Minister was not willing to say that Bill 21 is something that he's going to fight. He says it's a discriminatory, but he also says it's up to Quebec to make its own decisions. The Bloc Québécois leader today, Yves-François Blanchet, was saying that Bill 21 has no influence or impact on anywhere else in Canada, which is a pretty hard thing for me to reconcile in my mind, that if one part of the country is sending a message about how people are allowed to be identified, that that doesn't somehow bleed into people's consciousness and acceptance of people. So, yes, Islamophobia seems to be a term politicians are more comfortable with, but I don't know. Maybe I sound really glass half empty here to you. I don't know.
No, I think, I mean, like, that is the realistic view of this, right? And the idea that this could boomerang again and we can start having the conversation again, but, like, is Islamophobia real or is it not? Like, it just, it's really hard to communicate the gravity of the consequences of having this be a debate, having this be a political sort of debate. I'll use myself as an example for a second. Like, I remember the very first major gathering at the mosque in Kingston after 9/11, and there were two cop cars. I was 13 years old at this point. There were two cop cars outside for the duration of the prayer. And then they showed up at the next one and the next one. And sometimes the cops started showing up for just regular Friday prayers. Like the police cars would just be parked outside the mosque. And I was young then. I couldn't quite place whether they were there because Muslims were under increased surveillance or because they have information about something that could happen to us that they wanted to stop or maybe try to intervene in. And then years later, 3 weeks after I started working at BuzzFeed, I got my very first hate mail. I still have it. I keep it at my desk. It's like right in front of me right now. it's like a piece that I return to often where someone said, like, they printed out my tweets and they sent it to me in the mail, like snail mail. And it was like a sort of a letter criticizing Muslims. In 2018, there was a far-right YouTuber who made this elaborate video basically splicing together a bunch of TV appearances I did where she argued that I'm like a Muslim sleeper agent and I'm proof that the CBC is enabling Muslims to take over the media, to which like at the time I joked that I'm the laziest sleeper agent that I know, which is still true, you know? Like it truly is true.
Thank you for making me laugh at that moment.
Yes, of course. It's so silly. It's such a silly notion. But the truth of it is that, like, it kind of did rattle me that someone spent... I mean, it's like a 45-minute clip. It's genuinely overwhelming. And from time to time, I get these tweets and I get these emails that are threatening or trollish or racist, just, like, really ugly stuff. And I am grateful to have an ignore and block button, but I do not use it. And the reason I don't use it is that I don't feel like I can afford to ignore those things. Because... you know, even if a tweet is coming from an account with no followers or created yesterday, I want people to understand that this is not just a me thing. Like, being Muslim in Canada means that you constantly have to make a threat assessment. Am I safe right now? Even if the answer is probably yes, you still got to run the numbers. And not just for yourself, but, like, for everyone you know. And that takes its toll on you. Because, you know, I think about the six people who died in the Quebec City mosque shooting in 2017. They were just showing up for a mosque on a regular day like they always did. The Afzal family was just going for a walk. So, you know, when I hear the horror that people have when they see these stories, I feel validated. But then that validation loses something when it's paired with this notion that, like, this isn't who we are. Because... I don't know. Like, I love this country, but also I learned that this is a part of who we are at 13 years old. I don't have the luxury of pretending otherwise. And, you know, like, don't take it from me. Take it from Jeff Bennett, who ran for the PC party in London, Ontario, in the very riding where this tragedy took place. He's a white man with a name that's really familiar to a lot of white people. And he wrote on Facebook about how when he was knocking on his doors in the riding, he was greeted with relief from potential voters who were like, thank God you are white. And here's what he wrote. He wrote, now I see people expressing shock that a racist terrorist would drive this truck into the pathway of a Muslim family going for a walk. London is better than this, they say. I knocked on thousands of doors in the very neighborhood this atrocity occurred. This terrorist may have been alone in that truck, but he was not acting alone. Jeff Bennett ended that statement by saying, he was raised in a racist city that pretends it isn't. Like, that sits heavy with me.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry that that stuff happens to you, but it is easy to ignore if you're white, right? Because I don't get that kind of stuff. I mean, I get other stuff, but I don't get that kind of stuff. I don't have to, you can choose not to see that stuff, I guess, is my point. And when we were doing some of the research for the show, I was pretty horrified to see that this software company back in 2016, Sisian, documented a 600% rise in the amount of intolerant hate speech in social media postings by Canadians. So a lot of that ugliness is living in that space. And it's part of the reason that Canada in 2019 signed on to the Christchurch Declaration after the shootings in New Zealand to try and eliminate extremist online content. It's part of the reason the government has promised again and again and again and still not tabled legislation to try and control online hate. But that is, like, it's interesting to me that that is a place where you can go or you can be targeted, but it's also a place where, as a Canadian, you can ignore and it can happily sort of feed into your belief that this country is fine and that it's fine for everybody. The Prime Minister said something else in the House this week that sort of sat the wrong way with me. He said, I got his meaning, but it sat the wrong way. He said, just as Canadians mobilized to fight COVID, the country must come together to fight the ugly, pervasive trend of anti-Muslim violence. Like, I get what he's saying, but it, I think, negates the fact that there are people not interested in that fight.
Yes.
that don't want to take that on, that there is no, for them, benefit of doing that the way there would be through a pandemic, that that's someone else's problem. And I think equating those things is a little bit dangerous because it almost speaks to your privilege to be able to say that way. And I guess it also speaks to the question of, like, how do we deal with this? How do politicians deal with this?
Well, one thing that they can do is invent a public language where we can talk about this stuff in an uncomfortable way. And, like, it is hard for a politician to come out and say uncomfortable truths and still ask for people's votes. Because I think part of what we expect a politician to do is basically, like, represent the best version of us in them.
Right.
And sometimes that means ignoring the hard stuff or not saying the hard stuff. And to that end, actually, the speech that Jagmeet Singh made this week was one of those speeches that I didn't expect a politician to make, because it is then hard to turn around and ask people for their votes after you say, this is the version of Canada that you exist in. Here was his speech.
The reality is our Canada is a place of racism, of violence, of genocide of Indigenous people, and our Canada is a place where Muslims aren't safe. They aren't. They aren't safe. Muslims are not safe in this country. And Muslims wonder, I've spoken to people, they wonder, how many more lives will it take? How many more families will be mauled down the street? How many more families will be killed before we do something?
To me, I hear that speech, and I'm very moved by it, but also at the same time, I'm keeping in mind the duality of the fact that he then has to turn around and ask people for votes while telling them that this is the Canada they exist in. Mm-hmm. I applaud him for saying some of those things that are hard for people to hear, but also at the same time, I wonder how he's going to sell that to people.
Yeah, and because he himself represents some of this discomfort for some people in this country, it, you know, that has caused him problems, popularity problems in Quebec, the fact that he wears a turban. And you are obviously more connected to a story when you yourself see how you could be targeted. But you're right. In terms of sort of crass politics, it becomes difficult to see how he appeals then to some of the people who maybe don't feel the same way as him.
So when we combine the statement from Michelle Rempel-Garner and this Facebook post from Jeff Bennett, who ran for the PCs, that's really interesting to me. It's really interesting because it appears to be the beginning of a reckoning with maybe a political history or political legacy of being comfortable with courting people who have Islamophobic tendencies, or comfortable with actively courting people who want to encourage racism in this country. That is the first step. I wonder what happens next. I wonder what policies come out of this if you're the Conservative Party and you would like to put this behind you so that you don't have these associations with your party. Part of me wonders whether Aaron O'Toole will, you know, make a statement about how he voted on Motion 103. I think there's a lot of avenues for where that party can go, but generally speaking, the statements are the beginning. Then you want to see where else these parties take it in terms of what policies they start proposing. So I'm curious to see what comes from that.
Throughout the 1980s, a strange phenomenon was sweeping North America.
They were in a panic, and like people in a panic, they want solutions.
Allegations of underground satanic cults torturing and terrorizing children. The thing is, there were no satanic cults preying on children. And nearly 30 years later, the people touched by it all are still picking up the pieces.
This isn't a work of fiction. This is a work of history.
Satanic Panic, available now.
As we have spent a little while here, I think, grappling with, you know, this country's history, who we are, who we want to be, you know, just small questions.
Just the tiniest little
questions. Just a little thing. I was thinking about the high school I went to. So obviously I'm from Winnipeg, and I went to a high school called Churchill High School. It was named, obviously, for Winston Churchill. Our logos were bulldogs, so that's what was on my volleyball uniform. Okay. Yep. And, you know, I had a vague notion of who Winston Churchill was, and obviously grew to understand more who he represented, what he represented. What was your school named?
Bay Ridge. Bay Ridge Secondary.
Bay Ridge.
It's just about an area of town. That's really... Okay.
That's good. I wondered, though, about Ryerson University in Toronto, where a number of professors had sort of gathered together to try and change the name of the school and remove a statue of Edgerton Ryerson, who was one of the architects of the residential school system. And so, you know, seeing the statue of him every day, going to school with his name on it every day, after, you know, the weeks that we have had now talking about and thinking about residential schools, becomes heavy for a lot of people, and particularly for Indigenous students, to the point where they decided that they were just going to take down the statue. And in these really dramatic pictures and video, they pulled it down, they cut off his head, and they threw it in the water on Sunday. And that was a rally, and there were people there, and it was partly in response to what was uncovered in Kamloops, British Columbia. But it also, I think, leads to a bigger question around the names of these historical figures. Ryerson is one of them, but John A. MacDonald is a much more prominent one, where there are other places in the country where they have decided they are no longer comfortable with having him memorialized in statues. In Picton, Ontario, they've decided to take the statue down and put him in storage. A statue was removed in Charlottetown. It's happened in Victoria. It's happened in multiple places across the country because John A. MacDonald, as well as being a founding father of this nation, also had a hand in residential schools. I don't think it's as easy as saying all of these things should be removed. I don't think it's as easy as that. And I wonder what it says about how we are dealing with our history and the pace of change as we sort of grapple with how do we deal with these historical figures of the past who are representative of many things.
I will say that it is a hard conversation to have because it's genuinely a hard conversation to have about symbolism. And symbolism is often seen, I think, by some people as a lesser arena of sorts. Like people always want to talk about, you know, broader ideas, policy ideas, that kind of thing. But I think like what we've learned from this week and the last week is that symbolism is like the whole ball game. Like symbols can be so important for nation making. I grew up in Kingston. It's a city that would extremely like to let you know that it is the home of Sir John A. Macdonald. It's very forward about that. I briefly lived just off Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard. And I guess my question is, what do people get out of these symbols? We have history books. We have history books that are being revised all the time to kind of be a bit more precise about our understanding of historical events. But statues, by their nature, elevate a single figure to, I guess, like one idea of who they were. And they necessarily tend to kind of like, you know, erase the rest, or at least like that is a part of the point, you know, by memorializing some of these people, whether it's statues or whether it's like even something like street names, for that matter. So the symbols like becomes like its own story, and we sort of start to write out the rest of what it also means. I'm thinking here, of course, of also things like Jarvis Street here in Toronto. The Jarvis family was a family that owned slaves, but not only did they own slaves, but at the time, Lieutenant Governor John Graves Simcoe was trying to make slavery illegal in Upper Canada. Jarvis fought vigorously to keep slaves. Jarvis Street is one of the main arterial roads here in Toronto, and there's been, you know, sort of like an ongoing and continuously returning kind of conversation about whether the street should be renamed or not. But the greater point is this. The greater point is that when it's a statue or when it's a street name or something so visible, the rest of us just kind of have to live with that and look at it all the time. And look at it all the time in what kind of appears to be a single dimensionality. And I'm not really sure how moving forward or reconciliation is possible when you constantly have to look at the symbol and say, people before us, generations before us, thought that this person should be elevated, and now we know a little bit more about all the things that they participated in, and maybe their legacy is a little bit more complicated, but the statue doesn't say that, nor does the street name. All that does is just elevate the name.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it also presents sort of one side of history, right? Like if you put someone literally on a pedestal, you are saying one thing about them. You are not saying, oh, this is complicated. Let's explain the history here. You're just saying this person deserves to be elevated in this way.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe there's a way to do it so that the complexities can be demonstrated, or maybe they just have to come down. In the case of what was previously known as the Langevin block here in Ottawa, Hector Langevin, another politician who was involved in residential schools, the Prime Minister's office found that they wanted to remove that name from the building where his office is. So it's now just the Prime Minister's office. But down the street, down that exact same street there on Wellington in front of Parliament, there's a new building that they've renovated and that they hold press conferences in almost every day, and that is called the John A. Macdonald Building. And they sit there, politicians, you know, government members and others, and give press conferences in a place that has been named in tribute and to recognize and honor John A. Macdonald. Mark Miller, who's the Minister of Indigenous Services and has been obviously front and center during these stories about reconciliation and residential schools, was asked about removing John A. statues, for instance. And his answer is, it's interesting. Take a listen.
Knocking things down, breaking things is not my preferred option. Turning my eyes away from things is not my preferred option. Looking at things as painful as they are, explaining why they are, is my preferred option.
So I think that's a really interesting and thoughtful approach to all of this. I'm sure a lot of people would disagree with him, though, that you are not necessarily confronted with all the things that he's saying there just by seeing a statue or just by seeing a street name or just by seeing a building name, that all those things don't naturally occur to you. And they don't naturally occur to you depending very much on who you are, right? I mean, he even said it there, like, okay, I can walk into the John A. McDonald and maybe be okay with it, but a First Nations person might have a different view. I'll just add that Jason Kenney, the premier of Alberta, who is a bit of a history buff, has spoken out recently strongly about this as well, suggesting that removing these things amounts to quote-unquote cancel culture, that you have to recognize former leaders for what they did, not just the bad things, but the good things too.
I mean, if we're recognizing former leaders for what they did, let us also recall that Sir John A. Macdonald won the first election because the Liberals didn't have a leader. But that is like a whole other conversation. We could return to that some other time. All I'm saying is literally no competition. George Brown was not actually the leader of the... Anyway, just if we want to get into the history bits of it. But I think like to connect it back to this idea that we were talking about earlier of who we are as a nation. You know, history is really important and nobody wants to cancel history. But history doesn't live on the street in the same way that it does in a museum, in the same way that it does in a book. Because when I go to a museum, I'm choosing to engage with all the facets of history that are hard to contend with. I'm choosing to spend time with that information. Mm-hmm. When I open a book that is giving a historical context to something that I would like to grapple with, I'm reading a bunch of analyses that are kind of being connected together for me. When I'm just passing a statue on the street, I still think we have this cultural reverence of the idea of like, here's a statue of someone who deserves one. And that's kind of the end of the story with statues. It's really hard to communicate a more complicated idea because they are, by their nature, as you mentioned earlier, just a literal elevation of a person by giving them that pedestal, by saying this person should be memorialized and recognized as part of this place, and it's important that you know who they are. And I think that is what people are reacting to, is that giving history its due is important, but the way that you do that is not, to me anyway, it's not through a contextless statue. It's not even through adding plaques to statues that exist, because like, what can you really say in 300 words? Whereas if I'm going to a museum, I can choose to engage with these ideas. I'm showing up in preparation to engage with these ideas, and that is clearly a much richer engagement mechanism for people.
Yeah, I would just say I feel like this conversation is happening very slowly because it came up during the Black Lives Matter movement as people in the U.S. were contending with statues of Confederate leaders and deciding they had to pull them down. I feel like it's happening slowly in this country, and it's happening really hyper-locally as communities decide we are uncomfortable with this, so we're going to remove it. And that's why, you know, to the minister's point, I can see how these are decisions that are going to be made differently throughout the country. But I think, you know, there are countries in the world that have made really firm decisions on how to deal with their history. Germany is probably the best example of that. There are no memorials or any evidence of the Nazi regime. Mm-hmm. They have chosen to pay tribute to the people killed. But if you go to the United States, you can visit plantation sites, which were homes to slaves. So, you know, I think we have some lessons to learn from other countries, but I also think that we probably need to do this by being informed by the people in the community who are talking about discomfort with some of these symbols and why they need to do something different or say something different. The sound of Last Call here on the podcast. Last week, we didn't ask you a question in particular, but we focused our entire episode on reconciliation following the discovery of possible remains of children at the site of the former Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia.
And I have to say, you know, we've been doing the show for a couple of years, and I don't think we've seen a response like the response we saw to that episode. So we heard from so many different people who listened to that one. Thank you, folks, for listening and for sharing it with your friends. It was quite something to see.
Yeah, we were really happy to contribute in any way to the conversation. So it wasn't a last call, but we did ask you to try and evaluate how you think the country's doing on the path to reconciliation.
One listener tweeted, I'll hold my optimism at what this moment may be bringing until we see how the governments, the churches, and the media are acting in 1 week or 1 month when the initial pain subsides and the real work begins. Another person wrote, Canada needs to do better. The Governor General fiasco presents an opportunity. Instead of a Governor General, why not consider the head of government position to be whomever is the National Chief? I assume they mean the National Chief of Assembly of First Nations. The current National Chief, Perry Bellegarde, did say earlier this year that it's time for Canada to have its first Indigenous Governor General. We should be hearing about who may be next to take that role before the end of this month.
Mm-hmm. It's not me, for the record.
No, me neither.
This week, we do want to ask you what we're talking about there at the end, and that is sort of how we are dealing with our history when it comes to symbols, existing statues, monuments, names, street names. How do you feel we're dealing with it and confronting it? Should we be doing it differently? You can tweet us. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. Please throw in the hashtag. The hashtag is PartyLines, and let us know what you think.
That's it for Party Lines this week from CBC News and CBC Podcast. I'm Rosemary Barton, Chief Political Correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud, Culture Writer for BuzzFeed News.
See you back here next week.
You bet. See you then.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.